Welcome to the recording of Hope in the Face of Uncertainty. This session was recorded on the 11th of September 2010 at a forum for women living with advanced cancer. The forum was organised jointly by the Cancer Council of Victoria and BRECAN and was held at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre located in Melbourne's CBD. Kate Wakelin from the Cancer Council Victoria has a background in palliative care nursing and psycho-oncology, and many years of experience supporting people living with cancer. Kate discusses maintaining hope in the face of uncertainty and practical strategies for living well. We hope you enjoy this session, Hope in the Face of Uncertainty.
Okay, good. There were a few people who couldn't come today, so we were hoping to record it. Not that they wanted to make me feel any under any more pressure than I was already feeling, but anyway, just for the next little while, I sort of hesitated when we started to, when I was asked to speak, because I thought, well, what would I know? I don't have cancer, but I guess we've sat in the same room a lot, and so I feel really privileged and humbled to have walked a little way with a lot of women who are doing this, and you know, I actually feel really enriched and privileged to hear the tips and the coping strategies that the women have shared in these groups. And so I need to acknowledge the telephone and internet support groups who have given me such a rich field to draw from in preparing this talk. So I just wanted to say that up front and thank all of the people who I've spoken to over the years who have helped formulate this. So we're going to talk a little bit for the next little while, or I'm going to talk a little bit about living with advanced cancer, and just, I don't want to dwell too much on this, but I did want to talk a little bit about what some of the common issues are. And I said to someone before, in the week before, you know, my aim is to not make people feel too depressed, but to normalise some of the things that you might be dealing with in your day-to-day life. And the other aim of my talk was to provide some inspiration without making you feel guilty for not being able to do it all today, because I think that's a huge balance. And sometimes there's all the things that you know that you could do or that maybe you should do, but then there's only so much in the energy bank, and so it's about picking which bits are realistic to do on the day. So that's my hope. We'll see how we go. I think this quote's really interesting. I hang on to my favourite daydream, in which I receive a call from the oncologist who apologises profusely for misdiagnosing my condition. In this dream, she tells me that basically all I have is a form of internal dandruff. And I think sometimes that's what people think hope is, that it's reaching for something that might actually be a bit unattainable or feel a bit unattainable. And so sometimes people tell me, well, what is there to hope for? What point is there in hope? And I think that comes down to what you define hope is. And I'll be looking a little bit more about that as we move through. So as I said, I'm not aiming to depress you, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this stuff, but I did want to just go through some of the things that people who are living with advanced cancer do face. Fatigue is probably the most common thing that people with cancer experience, and we know that you know, even people who are cancer-free currently and have had their treatment and are trying to get on with their normal lives, they frequently have an ongoing level of fatigue. For advanced cancer, we know that's a significant problem. And someone said to me once, I didn't know what fatigue was. I didn't know what tired meant until I had cancer. It was like nothing else I'd ever imagined or experienced. Sometimes nausea is an ongoing problem. We've got a lady in our group at the moment who's having ongoing problems with nausea. And for her, that's made every aspect of her life really hard. And it's just like a shadow that's pervading her whole day. So nausea is a hard one. Often taste and appetite changes come, and that's often related to treatment. But I guess when you look at all of these are things that will impact on your enjoyment of your day-to-day life. I mean, sitting down and enjoying dinner with your family, if you've got a mouthful of ulcers or your taste is metallic, that's going to really take away from your ability to enjoy that time. Weight changes, and often people think when you've got advanced cancer you should be losing weight and gaunt, but often people put weight on and that affects your self-esteem as much as the weight loss. Hormonal changes, so when you thought you'd gone through menopause, maybe it's coming again, or maybe you're way too young to have gone through menopause and you're dealing with it at the wrong time of life. Scars are certainly, and skin changes. And these are things, again, they affect your self-esteem, they affect your enjoyment of life, they affect your ability to go about your day-to-day activities. But there's also social changes. One of the things we talk about often in the support groups is the way that friends react to people when they're going through a cancer. And a lot of people tell me, well, you really find out who your friends are, that sometimes the people who are supportive aren't the people you would have expected. And sometimes the people who you really would have been thinking that they'd be there for you as a close friend find it so hard to cope with that they pull away. And so there's often a lot of grief with that friendship, with those changes in friendships. There's also changes in intimate relationships, in relationships with partners. And sometimes that's linked to hormonal changes and things like fatigue, but a lot of women tell me, I just don't feel sexy anymore. And that's, again, I guess there's a grief associated with that. Certainly, parenting can be really challenging, but not to forget dealing with your parents. A lot of the people who I speak to, they've got ageing parents who are dealing with their illness, and they've got grief on board too, and so there's really complicated dynamic going on there, and again, it's something that makes life pretty tricky. And isolation, and I think that's the thing that people tell me most of all, is I feel so alone. And I think Barb mentioned that in the support group, that was one of the things that she got out of that, was not feeling so alone. So I think a lot of these things can make us feel like we're the only one going through it. And I guess that's the value of something like today, or something that I hope that people get out of today, is not feeling like you're the only one going through this, that you're part of actually a really large group of people who are travelling this together. So there's understandably a whole heap of emotional issues or impacts from cancer, and it can be from, just that living with uncertainty, not really knowing what's around the corner. And, I've heard people argue, well, no one knows what's around the corner. I could get hit by a bus next week. But the fact of having cancer is that that's heightened. That's in the forefront of your mind often. A lot of people feel anger. And one thing that I wanted to say up front was that these impacts are not just for the person with cancer, but the ripple effect. So the partners, the families, the friendships, the loved ones, and the work colleagues. So sometimes you're at a different emotional space from the people who are around you. And I know a lot of men feel anger in a different way to women. It can be tricky if you're feeling sad and he's feeling angry, or she's feeling depressed and you're feeling energised. So it can be difficult when you're at a different emotional space. Sometimes people feel hopeless, and that's a really hard thing. Certainly grief, as I mentioned before. Sometimes guilt. most people who are going through this can think of something, maybe, and even if it's not reasonable or legitimate, something that they could have done. Maybe I should have exercised more. Maybe I should have eaten better. Maybe I should have moved to the country and not breathed in all those chemicals. A lot of us think about things that we could have done for this not to happen. And so a lot of people feel guilt, and guilt at the ongoing impact of not being able to do the things that you would normally be able to do. Fear of death. I mentioned decreased self-esteem before, so all of those things that affect us physically affect us emotionally as well. And I guess the whole issue of identity, who am I now? I've got this cancer, and it's different to, for most people it's different to who I feel like I am having had cancer and had treatment, and okay, well the focus then is on, okay, getting back to normal, and sometimes that's really hard too, but having cancer that's not going away, am I a survivor? Who am I? What does that mean about the person who I'm looking in the mirror and seeing? And do I recognise that person with all these physical changes? And we know that anxiety and depression are really common. So sometimes it's about grief that makes it difficult. And I think sometimes looking at it through a pair of grief glasses can actually be quite helpful in working out what all of this means. A lot of people who are going through advanced cancer find that there's so much that they can't control about their lives. you know, you can't control the cancer, you know, there's less choice in what you're able to do. You're governed by your energy levels and the treatment and the appointments and all of that stuff. You know, grief about role and identity. Well, again, that person in the mirror is not who I recognise, and where is she gone? Or the person who I'm living with isn't the person that I thought I'd be with right now. Where is she gone? And grieving that person, grieving friendships and those changes that happen in relationships. So I wanted to talk a little bit about depression and anxiety in cancer, and I don't want to make this a really technical lecture, but I think there's some background here that might be helpful to understand or get some information on in order to understand where we're at. So please excuse me while I give you a little bit of Depression and Anxiety 101, but I think there's some interesting stuff here. We know that about 17% of the Australian community suffer from depression. Well, that's actually a reasonably significant number, and if I say think about my circles of family and friends, actually there's quite a lot of people who are, when you dig down a bit below the surface, you realise that depression's played a part in their life. And so I guess what that tells me is that a lot of people find just normal everyday life pretty tough, pretty much a struggle, and maybe it's a bit wobbly, and then when cancer comes along, it's just the straw that breaks the camel's back. And we know that up to 50% of people with cancer suffer significant levels of depression and anxiety. That number changes according to which scale you use and which book you read, but we know that there's a significant number. One of the tricky things about this is that the symptoms of depression and anxiety often can be the same as the symptoms that you might get from the cancer and the cancer treatment. So things like, you can see fatigue, low energy, loss of appetite, loss of sleep, psychomotor retardation. I'm sorry, that's a really technical word, but it just means that you're not so good with your hand-eye coordination, or you might be moving a bit slower. So it can be really difficult to tease out, well, what's normal due to the cancer, and what's normal, a normal emotional reaction? What's just grief? And what's depression and anxiety that maybe we should be looking at going to see a doctor about, and maybe looking at medication? So, and I guess as health professionals, these are the questions that we're trying to get a handle on as well, and we're scratching our heads as much as you guys sometimes about what do we do with this feeling, this dread. David Clark is a psychiatrist. He works at Monash Medical Centre, and I just heard him speak a couple of weeks ago, and he, for me, really, there was a real aha moment when he described depression in three categories when someone has cancer. And the first one is demoralisation, and that really comes about for people when they can't see solutions to the problems. And sometimes that's practical stuff. Sometimes it's not being able to pay the bill. Sometimes it's getting home from hospital and getting the myriad of receipts and dockets and appointments and bills and things to take to Medicare and things to take to Medibank private. And, you know, people have told me I needed to hire a personal assistant, like a secretary, to deal with all the paperwork. Sometimes it's the practical stuff and feeling overwhelmed by that stuff, you know, the weeds in the garden and the, you know, all of the other stuff that makes up our lives apart from the cancer that can lead to that sense of demoralisation, so that sense of helplessness or hopelessness. But we know there's a lot of grief in this too, and that can be that sense of loss and that sense of sorrow and those pangs of, I didn't ask for this. This isn't what it's supposed to be. And anhedonia, and I'm sorry, that's another technical word, but really that's talking about loss of interest or pleasure. So for people where things might be really rough, but you get them to speak about their grandkids and they get the smile on their face, or get them to talk about the day they met their partner and their wedding day, and they can go to that happy place. With anhedonia, you can talk about those things that would normally bring you joy, or you can engage in those things that would normally bring you joy, and they don't, the joy's gone. And that's another category, I guess, of that depression. And I guess the thing about those three categories that David's identified is that the things that as health professionals and your treatment team would depend on where you're sitting emotionally with that stuff. So we know with demoralisation now that actually offering practical support is really important. You know, so sometimes it is about a financial grant or getting a cleaner or organising home help or things like that, that's actually the thing you need. You might not actually need counselling. For things like grief, you know, sometimes just talking it over, normalising some of that stuff, putting it, you know, just saying it, acknowledging it, saying, well, of course, you're feeling sad about this. And then, you know, that support sharing in a support group environment might be really helpful. But we know with anhedonia, that's a category that sometimes doesn't respond to those other measures like support groups and counselling and practical supports. And sometimes we know that seeing a psychiatrist or a really good GP and making some, you know, having a good think about maybe antidepressants in that situation might be really helpful. So there's still lots of question marks about what we do with this. And I'm going to talk now about, well, what's this all got to do with hope? Because you might be sitting here thinking, well, why are they telling me about depression when I came to hear about hope? So I wanted to talk a bit about hope. And when I was doing some thinking and some reading about this, I came across the story of Pandora's Box, and I'm sure you must all have heard the story about Pandora and how she lifts the lid on the box and all the troubles come out, all the troubles of the world. And I found a really lovely retelling of this story by a chap called Nathaniel Hawthorne, who wrote it as a children's story in 1852, and this really captured my imagination, so I'm just going to read you a little bit from it. As Pandora raised the lid, the cottage grew very dark and dismal, for the black cloud had now set quite over the sun and seemed to have buried it alive. Pandora lifted the lid nearly upright and looked inside, and it seemed as if a sudden swarm of winged creatures brushed past her, taking flight out of the box, while at the same instant she heard the voice of Epithemius with a lamentable tone, as if he were in pain. There were evil passions, there were a great many species of cares, there were more than 150 sorrows, there were diseases in a vast number of miserable and painful shapes, there were more kinds of naughtiness than would be ever used to talk about. In short, everything that has since afflicted the souls and bodies of mankind had been shut up in the mysterious box. And then Pandora shuts the box and they go through a period of living with all of these sorrows and all of these cares and the naughtinesses of the world. And then she hears a tapping on the inside of the lid of the box. And she says, "Who are you?" asks Pandora with little of her former curiosity. "Who are you inside of this naughty box?" A sweet little voice spoke from within. "Only lift the lid and you will see." "No, no," answered Pandora, beginning to sob. "I've had enough of lifting the lid. You are inside of the box, naughty creature, and there you shall stay. There are plenty of your ugly brothers and sisters already flying about in this world. You need never think that I should be so foolish as to let you out." And she finds that the curiosity takes over, and she does lift that lid. So with one consent, the two children again lifted the lid. Out flew a sunny and smiling little personage and hovered about the room, throwing a light wherever she went. Have you never made the sunshine dance into warm corners by reflecting it from a little bit of looking glass? Well, so looked the winged cheerfulness of this fairy-like stranger amid the gloom of the cottage. She flew to Epithemius and laid the least touch of her finger on the inflamed spot where the trouble had stung him. Immediately the anguish it was gone. Then she kissed Pandora on the forehead and her hurt was cured likewise. A bit of microphone adjustment. "Pray, who are you, beautiful creature?" inquired Pandora. "I am to be called Hope," answered the sunshiny figure. "And because I'm such a cheery little body, I was packed into the box to make amends to the human race for that swarm of ugly troubles which was destined to set loose amongst them. Never fear, we shall do pretty well in spite of them all." "Your wings are coloured like the rainbow," exclaimed Pandora. "How very beautiful." "Yes, they are like the rainbow," said Hope. "Because glad as my nature is, I'm partly made of tears as well as smiles." So I wanted to explore this idea of hope. How can it exist amongst all of these troubles? And I guess that's what we're all here to think about and wonder about and scratch our heads about together. But I wondered for you, if you just sit here and think, well, what does hope mean to me? Is it that the cancer's an internal dandruff? Is it an unattainable thing? Is it seemingly lost right now? Or is it something that can coexist amongst all of this box of troubles? In a little while after this talk, we're going to have a chance to talk about this in groups, and I'd be really interested to hear your reflections on what we think hope is. But a couple of people you might not be surprised to hear have done a bit of thinking about this over time. And there's a chap called Snyder who said it in an interesting way, and I think the first definition is a bit wordy: the perceived capacity to derive pathways to desired goals and motivate oneself by agency thinking to use those pathways. I heard someone else sum that up in probably a slightly more succinct way by saying having a will and a way. And I would add a goal into that. So having something that you're wanting to attain, and having the will to do it, having the energy, and then knowing that there's a pathway for it. So I guess when I was thinking about this talk, to me hope felt quite different to optimism, because I guess optimism is really thinking that everything's going to turn out all right, whatever happens. And often for people with cancer that's advanced, that's not necessarily the way you see the world, although some people still find that's a useful way of looking at things. But I think it is different from that blind faith, you know, gosh, can that fish actually get up into the fishbowl? And although some people find positivity really helpful, I know that some people find it a real prison. And Leslie Fallowfield has really talked to us and spoken to, when I read her work, it speaks really loudly to me about sometimes people feel really guilty for not feeling positive. And I think positivity is different from hope. In our telephone support group, I felt really privileged to witness some really amazing and mind-bending discussions about the balance between hope and acceptance. And Barbara, you really brought this to my mind when you were speaking before too, about the fact that you gave away your diamonds. And you did get your head around the fact that this cancer's not going away, it's not going anywhere. And so for you there was a sense of, well, this might be it. And we don't know how long that is, but this might be it. This probably will be it at some point. And how we balance that with hope. And it's acceptance, giving up. And I think the thing that listening to the conversations in the telephone and internet support groups has taught me is that acceptance is quite different from giving up for most people. And I didn't bring it, but sometimes I get a visual picture of a unicycle where you see people riding their unicycle and they're kind of swinging backwards and forwards, and sometimes they look like they're going to fall off one direction and then they correct themselves and they go the other direction. And I think sometimes hope and acceptance can be a bit like that, where there is that balance, and it can be pretty wobbly at times. And I guess for some people there can be times where acceptance isn't there, and sometimes there can be times where hope isn't there. But it's about trying to navigate that. So I wanted to talk a little bit about hope and depression, and there's some work by a psychologist called Penny Schofield, which I've been doing some reading in this past few weeks and found it really helpful. And there's a podcast on the ABC Radio National from Penny Schofield, and she talks about her work. So I'd encourage you, if you're interested in hearing a bit more about the link between, or the lack of link between hope and depression, the ABC Radio National is a really good, it's from the Norman Swan Health Report. And I listened to that the other day and I thought, oh yeah, there's some good stuff there. But she's done heaps of studies on the nature of hope and about optimism and people with advanced cancer. And the latest study that she did, she measured there were some hope scales and there were some depression scales, and what she really found was there's like an inverse relationship between hope and depression. So if you've got a high level of depression, your hope's probably going to be lower, and if your hope's higher, it's like it fights the depression. And so I guess when we know that up to 50% of people with cancer have depression, significant levels of depression, we know that hope balance is going to be maybe a bit low for people. And given the challenges that we talked about earlier on, I guess that's not really surprising. But I guess what we do know is that there are some ways of nurturing hope and growing hope. And sometimes I like to think about hope as like a little seedling, like a little plant, that we need to actually do some things to nurture and encourage that to grow. So I'm going to go through some strategies that people, and particularly, and I need to thank our support groups for telling me these tips, because they're not from me, they're from the people who are walking this journey. And I'm hoping that through some of these strategies you'll find some things to take away, maybe some new ways of thinking about it for yourselves. Certainly we know seeking information is really important, and we've got a session on looking at that this afternoon, so I'm not going to spend a great amount of time. But I guess it's about control with information, and even understanding the emotional impact, and that's, I guess, why I did give that background about the depression and how that relates to hope. Because I think for myself, if I'm feeling really distressed about something, it helps me to get a bit of a cognitive or an intellectual understanding of what's actually going on. But then I think, you know, what we know is that peer support can be really important, just in terms of reducing isolation and making you feel normal. And what I describe this as powerful normalising, because there's only so much that me as a cancer nurse or a health professional can say to you, oh yeah, a lot of people feel like that. And, you know, that can be helpful to have that from your doctor or from your nurse. But getting it from someone else, and for someone else to say, oh God, it was like that for me too, and oh, it just about drove me spare, and this is what I did about it, that's often much more powerful. Peer support is about giving and receiving, and I was talking with Bob about this before. It's about so many things when cancer's advanced make you feel a bit like you're not so useful anymore. Sometimes you can't do your role, you can't do your job, you can't be as important or that useful person in the family anymore, and that's actually a source of real grief for people. In support groups, we get a chance to share our stories in a way that help other people, and I think that's really powerful. And the groups often just explore meaning together. And again, sometimes it's hard to find a safe space or the right people to look at that stuff together, because they can be pretty heavy conversations, and sometimes they're conversations you might not choose to have with your family or your friends. And I think that goes for the person with the cancer, but also with carers. You know, sometimes there's those feelings in there that you're not necessarily going to openly talk about with other people who are part of your circles. Sometimes it's actually good to talk to other people who are outside the situation. But I think there's also a role for getting professional help, and we certainly know, you know, if there's physical symptoms like pain, then there's often so much that we can do about it. And I was really encouraged, Barb, to hear that you were reassured about that. But things like managing that depression, that anxiety, if you are concerned or you're thinking, yeah, I'm not getting that pleasure out of the stuff that I would normally find pleasurable, that's a real ding, ding, ding. Time to go and talk to someone about this. There might well be something that we can do to help that. Getting support, and I guess going back to those three levels of depression and the demoralisation, getting practical support in things like parenting or paying the bills, dealing with those practical aspects of life. But also talking things over, maybe with a counsellor, about the aspects which you're grieving. And the practical issues, as I said. Some of the other things that people find helpful are just about acknowledging the losses. And I think I really talked about this a bit before, but sometimes it's just about saying, well, this sucks, doesn't it? And that's okay. It's sometimes just saying it out loud takes some of the power out of it. What we know is that sharing feelings for most people is helpful. Sometimes people think, oh, why would I want to talk about it? I'll just feel worse after I've pulled it all out of Pandora's box. But what we know is that sharing feelings often does help. And whether that's with your family and your people who are close to you, whether it's with your healthcare team, whether it's with someone like the Cancer Helpline or a support group. But sharing your feelings is something that we know most people find helpful. Humour. I think sometimes we forget about this. There's so much about this stuff that's so serious, but we still need to laugh, and laughing and humour and bringing light stuff into your life helps balance that, you know, all that heavy stuff. I was talking to someone a while ago who said she just felt so drab about everything. She went and hired the box set of Fawlty Towers, or there's not very many of them, is there? So she just hired the series, and she spent a couple of days watching the DVDs of Fawlty Towers to give her a starting point to actually start laughing, and that was really helpful for her. So I think sometimes we forget about doing things that are enjoyable, doing things that make us laugh. It doesn't have to be all really heavy. A lot of people find meditation helpful. Some people find it really irritating, but a lot of people find it helpful, so it's worth a try. And I know there's a session this afternoon on meditation. Diet and exercise, and I guess this is where I was thinking, now I want to give you some tools, but I don't want to make you feel guilty, because I know when energy's low and if your tastes change and your hormones are all over the place, diet and exercise are really hard. But again, it's something that we know, it's good to keep in mind. We know that eating well, we know that getting moving will help you feel better physically and also emotionally. So we know with exercise those endorphins will flow. So even if it's just going for a gentle walk around the block, for 10 or 15 minutes, we know that will have an impact. Just being deliberate about how you will live. And I guess that leads me into talking, and I wanted to talk just a little bit about the idea of mindfulness. And I guess some of you might have looked at this before. Some people link it very much to meditation, but mindfulness, if you're finding meditation a bit heavy and a bit hard, mindfulness is sometimes a different pair of glasses to look at things through. Okay. I must have added another slide in, but that's okay. So I just wanted to talk to you just briefly about mindfulness, in that it's a form of self-awareness. It's actually got Buddhist roots, but it's been adopted into the treatment of things like depression and anxiety quite a lot in the last few years. And there's some really good information on mindfulness at the Black Dog Institute. So if you want the details of where to grab that, I can talk to you about it. If I had a bit more time, I'd actually lead you through a simple mindfulness exercise. But I think if I do that, we'll run out of time. So, but just if you're interested in that as another technique or another tool, come and see me afterwards. So some other strategies. I guess again, it's this balance, but it maybe anticipating that things might change and making some plans about that. And sometimes having a plan helps you feel a bit less anxious. Putting the illness in its place. And I actually heard a really amazing talk by, probably a lot of you be familiar with Patria King, but I heard a talk by her a while ago where she said, you're not a cancer, you have a cancer. You're not a body, you have a body. And sometimes putting that illness in the place and saying, well, yeah, cancer's a part of who I am, but there's all of these other things that make me, and just remembering that, putting the illness in its place. Choosing your supports carefully, and Barb, I think you said this beautifully. Sometimes it's about staying away from the doom and gloom people. Sometimes it's staying away from the people who you know are going to say, oh, you're still here. Who's had that? Ask for help and give direction. And so sometimes the people around us really do want to help, but they don't quite know how, and sometimes they might choose a clumsy way of doing it. Sometimes they might do the wrong thing. So actually we need to take a bit of initiative and say, okay, it would be really helpful if you could drive me to my appointment at 2 o'clock on Thursday. Is that okay? Or I really need someone to clean my fridge. I'm sorry, but you did offer to help. The oven. The oven. Okay. Any volunteers for cleaning the oven over there? See her after the session. So I guess tips for communication, and I guess this is just acknowledging that when things are stressful, it does make it difficult to have conversations. Even those everyday mundane conversations about who's taking the bins out can sometimes get pretty strained. And so picking the time and the place, and sometimes if you know that you're going to need to talk about an issue or talk something over, plan ahead a bit and think, okay, well, Fix and Specs is on at 8:30 on a Wednesday night, so I won't choose that because I know he'll be watching that. But maybe at 9 o'clock when the gruen transfer's on, he might be more interested in having a chat. Talk about your feelings rather than the conclusion. So I guess that's things like using I statements. I'm feeling like... what's a good example? Can someone give me a good example? talking from your own perspective about how you're feeling rather than naming or making assumptions about what the things mean. It's important to have your ears turned on and to listen. Some couples or some families find it actually interesting or helpful to have like a talking ball or some symbol that says, okay, I'm the one who's talking now and everyone has to shut up and listen to me, and then it'll be your turn. So taking in turns, listening, and sometimes the other thing that goes with that is that if you've got the talking ball and you've said what you need to say, it's the other people's turn to actually restate what you said so that they make sure they've understood it and heard it clearly, and then you can say, well, actually, that wasn't what I meant at all. Or, you know, yeah, that's great, that's what I meant. And do it in small doses. You don't have to have all the conversations about everything all in one day. Like, that would be completely overwhelming. So just to do it in small doses, maybe to set the timer and say, we're going to talk about this for 10 minutes and then we'll come back to it next week. So doing those small doses of conversation can be really helpful. And I wanted to briefly talk about children. I know I haven't talked about this much at all, but I thought, well, I'll just spend just a minute or two on it. Kids will pick up on whatever's happening in the household. And a lot of people tell me initially, oh, well, we haven't told the kids, or we're just keeping their routine normal. When I talk to kids, what they tell me is, Mum's really sick and no one will talk to me about it. And often what will happen is, if we're not talking with our kids, if we're not communicating with them, they'll feel really guilty, and often they'll assume that it's something that they've done wrong, if we don't give them those reassurances that it's not your fault. So it is important to consider how we do that. The amount of information we give kids differs from age and stage. So for young children, it's a very different picture from what we would tell a teenager or a young adult. But I guess the take-home thing amongst all of this is honesty. Tell the truth. You don't have to tell the whole truth, but tell the truth. Don't tell them lies. Using real language is really important, and I guess the cancer stuff is a language we learn too. Our doctors and our health professionals talk to us in the jargon, and sometimes that becomes part of our own vocabulary without even thinking about it. It's important to use real words that the kids will understand. And small doses, like I said in the previous slide, sometimes it'll just be a brief bath time conversation. Routine is really important. So if Mum's not around to take the kids to soccer, then maybe that's something that a helpful friend might be able to do. So maintaining those routines and getting support. And there are really good supports for kids. I guess it's not your own children also. It might be friends' children or grandchildren that you're thinking about. There's actually a really good resource by the Cancer Council New South Wales, and I don't have the glossy coloured one, but you can download this from the Cancer Council New South Wales website, or you can ring us and we'll send you a photocopy of it. But it's actually a really good website. It's called Talking to Kids About Cancer. So that's a good one. And there's just a couple of other things I was going to show you. So I can see on the clock I've got about 2 minutes left, so I have got time, which is great. There is a good meditation CD, and it's part of our carers pack, and there, I think there's probably still some left on. There's one left. Yeah, so if you're interested, and the carers pack is a bundle of information, and I'm not going to open it because it'll just crackle on the microphone, but there's a whole heap of information and resources in there for people who are surrounding someone with cancer. But in there is a really good meditation CD that's put out by Western Australian Cancer Council, and we can send those out to you too. There's also a book that's put out by Beyond Blue, which really talks about, it's called Taking Care of Yourself and Your Family. It's not linked to cancer per se, but it does give you quite a lot of tools about dealing with anxiety, with depression, with stress. And if you're a person who finds it helpful to work through some things on a piece of paper, there's actually some good little charts and tables with gaps where you can actually sit down with a pencil and fill it in. So we've got heaps of copies at the Cancer Council. If you're interested in that, you can get it from us. Sometimes in the middle of the night, there's not the cancer helpline open. Your health professional's hopefully gone to bed at some point. So I'm going to give this a plug, and this is the Cancer Connections website. So it's www.cancerconnections.com.au, and there's brochures on the back table. It's an online community, so you can hop on. You can actually read other people's stories. People often use it in the middle of the night to go, whoa, this is happening. And so you'll find some people venting on there and saying things in a pretty raw and honest way. But it's a safe place to do that. And what I do, come on at 9 o'clock every morning and I'd go through all of the posts and we take away the spam, so the people who are coming on and trying to sell us the Russian bribes, they get a pretty quick flick. But it is a supportive place, and there are a lot of regular users on the site who will come on, and if you make a posting, they'll come and welcome you on. Interestingly, there's heaps and heaps of carers on this site, so family members, partners of people who are going through cancer. So I guess the advantage of this is that you can create your profile and you can call yourself Mickey Mouse. Only one of you can call yourself Mickey Mouse because there's only one user per name. Anyway, so you can post anonymously. So there's some real power in that. Sometimes it's difficult to be honest in our circles, and there's important reasons sometimes for, you know, padding things out and being a bit more gentle about the way you talk. But sometimes it's good to just say things how they are. And so you can hop on, you can create a pretty anonymous profile and link with people on a pretty real level. So I would encourage you to have a look at that. So just in summary, we know that there's heaps of issues and challenges with living with advanced cancer, and it can be really hard to maintain that unicycle ride and maintain that balance. So today I've talked about heaps of strategies that you might find helpful. The slides from this talk will be available afterwards. So if you didn't think, you know, if you think, oh, now what did she say in that blah, 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 you'll be able to get the recording or you'll be able to have a look at the slides. And I guess our next little while will be talking about this in small groups and for you to share your tips and strategies with each other. So I'm hoping there'll be some opportunities for you to pick what works for you and maybe even take a couple of ideas home. And this is one little thing that I might be able to do to make things just a little bit easier. And just to really pinpoint the importance of getting support for this. This is hard stuff. And you're not expected to do it on your own. I know it can feel really isolating, but you're not expected to do this on your own. And so I'd encourage you today to, you know, talk with each other, to meet each other, to share your stories, and maybe think about ways of continuing these friendships and these links through to the future. So I do thank you for your time and your attention today, and I'm really looking forward to talking with you more in the small groups. So. Before we go and have our morning tea, I'm just going to read you one tiny little bit more from this book. And Epimetheus, who's Pandora's playmate, said, "And will you stay with us forever and ever?" He's talking to Hope. "As long as you need me," said Hope with her pleasant smile, "and that will be as long as you live in the world. I promise never to desert you. There may come times and seasons now and then where you will think I've utterly vanished, but again and again and again, when perhaps you last dream of it, you shall see the last glimmer of my wings on the ceiling of your cottage." So, thank you. Thank you. Amanda's telling me to plug the cancer helpline. Oh, the helpline number is 13 11 20. Thanks, Amanda, but the brochures are on the back table. So, time for a cup of tea.
We hope you enjoyed this recording and found it helpful. To find out more about other sessions recorded on CD, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500 or via our email at brecan@brecan.org.au. Brecan is a statewide gynaecological and breast cancer support and information service located on the ground floor at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, 210 Lonsdale Street, Melbourne. Brecan is a service of Women's Health Victoria and is funded by the Department of Health. The Cancer Council provides support to people affected by cancer, including family and friends. Speak to one of their experienced and friendly cancer nurses via the Cancer Council helpline on 131120. They can provide you with reliable information and link you to others who have been through a similar experience. You can access support over the phone or in person. You can also chat to others online via a private online community. Visit www.cancervic, which is cancervic.org.au, or call 131120, Monday to Friday, 8:30 a.m. till 6 p.m. This service is confidential and multilingual. Thank you.